You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. According to our next guest, a basic understanding of the scientific world is a key to making informed decisions about everything from what to eat to which car we should buy, a lot of other stuff too. Larry Scheckel, a.k.a. Mr. Science, is a retired Tomah High School physics teacher. He writes a weekly science column for the Tomah Journal, and his new book is Ask a Science Teacher, 250 answers to questions you've always had about how everyday stuff really works. Larry, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
So I touched on this just now, but even if we're not scientists, why is it important to think scientifically?
Well, I think science is a cultural pursuit as well as any other kind of pursuit. And to know more about science is to understand our world, not to get ripped off in some cases, to appreciate the beauty of God's creation. So I think there's a lot of other reasons to understand science. Good voting decisions, for example.
A lot of us might think back to being overwhelmed by a particular science class or finding a topic over our head, but is it fun?
Well, I think it is. I think it's what the teacher makes us a lot of times, and sometimes we've gotten away from that rote memory kind of work, and it's more collaborative and project-based science that we see in schools today.
Now, you taught high school science there in Tomah for a good long time. What are some of the scientific questions that just keep coming up again and again for you over the years?
Well, it's the usual ones, Rob. It's the ones like, why is the sky blue and why is the grass green? If kids are asking questions, it's a lot to do with the human body, and they'll want to know why we burp or why we itch, or they want to know things about when they get a cold or a sickness or illness. If they're studying the stars, then there are questions about astronomy and things of that sort.
Well, I've got to say, I can't let it go. Our producer, Amanda Magnus, gave me one question that she was badgering me to ask you. Why is the sky blue?
the first one
you just listed.
Sure. And see, those are the toughest questions, the ones that are really seem simple. But the reason the sky is blue has to do with the scattering of light, reflection of light, wavelength, frequency. And the reason the sky is blue basically is that light is made up of seven colors, the so-called Roy G. Biv colors, the Biv, the blue, indigo, violet being the shortest waves, and the Roy, red, orange, yellow, being the longest waves. And blue, those short wavelengths, are scattered so much easier than any other wave. So when those light rays hit the atmosphere, molecules of oxygen and a little bit of particles of dust and smog, then the shorter particles reflect off of the light reflects off those particles, and that's called scattering. So it's the scattering, it's called Raleigh scattering, and it's wavelength dependent.
And it's different, or different things happen at sunset when you get those clouds in there and you get a little different scatter, I guess?
Yes, because when the sun is low on the horizon, either morning or evening, or if there's a lot of pollution in the atmosphere, the blue is all scattered out. So the only thing that's getting through then, through the atmosphere, is the Roy colors, the red colors. And that, therefore, we have the red sunsets and red sunrises.
Amanda is a grown-up of sorts, but that's a question that kids will often ask. They're really curious. Do kids ask better questions than grown-ups, do you think?
Well, I think they ask really simple questions, the kind of questions that, for example, that Einstein said that he always tried to answer. Kids will ask questions like, who made God and why? Why are people mean to each other? Why is there a chance that gravity may fall? What's the meaning of life? Why can't their dog talk? Why do pigs snort? Who's the shortest person on Earth? How long would it take me to get to Venus? They ask questions like that. And they're not afraid to ask those kind of questions that maybe grown-ups are a little reluctant to come up with.
Yeah, why don't grown-ups do that? Are we less curious, or do we just not want to look dumb and figure, oh, I should know this, everybody else does, so I'm not going to ask?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. People, you know, it's just a human reaction that we don't want to appear to be stupid or dumb, and therefore we don't ask those kind of questions that that probably a lot of other people are also asking.
And the worry that it might be over our heads, I think it was the physicist Richard Feynman who said, and I'm massively paraphrasing it wrongly here, but something like he told other scientists, if you can't explain it in a way your mom understands, you don't understand it well enough.
Well, that's right. And I remember Feynman saying that and reading about that. And it's true about in the very area of teaching. Now, my wife and I taught at Tolma High School here for a total of 70 years. And I taught physics for 38 and a half. And even after teaching that many years, I still had struggled with certain things that I taught, such as quantum mechanics or quantum physics or lasers and things like that. And it's the more a person teaches it, the better he himself understands it. So that's kind of a blessing to me, being able to try to explain it to others.
You've got 250 answers in your book. I want to get to some more of them during our conversation here. You mentioned kids asking about gravity. Let's tackle that one. Why does the Earth have gravity?
Well, the first one to really tackle that was Newton. And he basically said that any two objects that have mass have an attraction between them. And there's a formula, a well-known formula that he enunciated. But Einstein came along and said that gravity is the result of curved space, and that if an object is accelerating, then that acceleration engenders mass or gravity. And that's still not fully understood, you know, Rob, because you talk about the God particle or the Higgs particle that was recently talked about this last summer. They're trying to come up with a way to prove that mass or account for why objects have mass. So gravity is one of those great things that Einstein was told not to tackle after he had done relativity. He says, I'm too stubborn, I'm going to do it anyway. And he did, and we're all the better for it.
That's one of the most mind-blowing things to me is that gravity, right? We deal with it all the time. We drop stuff, we fall down, we have to fight it to stand up or jump up. And it's we don't understand exactly completely how it works.
Yes, that's true. Matter of fact, one of the questions that a kid asked is, if the moon is so heavy, why doesn't it fall? And that's a very tough question and to deal with.
Okay, go for it. Why isn't the moon conking us on the head?
Well, the reason is that it's in orbit around the Earth. And if the moon stopped dead in its tracks, it would be attracted to the Earth and smash into it. Now, if there was no gravity, on the other hand, the moon would just keep going in a straight line and be lost forever, like a rock that you swing around on a rope and then cut the rope and the rock goes twirling out. But those two things are operating together. At the same time it wants to go forward, gravity is pulling it a little bit towards the Earth, making it go into a circular, fairly circular orbit.
Here's a related one that I don't think it's in your book, but one that always baffled me. So all the planets, right, orbit around the sun on a plane.
Yeah.
It's not like one plane is Jupiter, one plane is Earth. Why? Why aren't they all going in their own sort of circles?
Well, I think that has to do, my best understanding of that is in the formation of the solar system, is that all this debris started accumulating and it got going into a circle. And the idea of the conservation of angular momentum, a fancy term that means that when objects go around and round, they like to be drawn inward. So it kind of makes sense that it would be into a plane rather than random, just because of the accretion of more and more material.
We're talking to Mr. Science, Larry Scheckel. His new book is Ask a Science Teacher, 250 Answers to Questions You've Always Had About How Everyday Stuff Really Works. I just asked one of mine. Now you can ask one of yours, and it doesn't have to be astronomy. We were on that for a little while there. Anything in the science world, maybe he can take a stab at it. You've always wondered why, but maybe been embarrassed to ask because you think it's obvious or somebody already knew it. Here's the number, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And if you stump him, you know, you've got something for his sequel there that he can tackle in his next book. You can also email your question. It's talk@wpr.org. We'll take your questions, and I've got a whole bunch more for him, too, coming up after we take a look at the latest Wisconsin news. By the way, if you're into the science, after five today, the hunt for neutrinos and the important role Wisconsin plays in hunting for this bizarre, elusive subatomic particle. And it was written, this book, in a way that I understand, so you will too. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on WPR. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Larry Scheckel, author of Ask a Science Teacher, 250 Answers to Questions You've Always Had About How Everyday Stuff Really Works. He's a retired physics teacher from high school in Toma. We're taking your questions about all things scientific, something you're curious about. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@WPR.org. Speaking of email, Jeff in Rhinelander emails us. Larry, he writes, why do we only see part of the moon? If we see the sun and part of the moon, it can't be reflected off the sun, right?
Yeah, we see part of the moon, the phases of the moon, I take it, that the questioner is asking. The phases are caused because the moon goes between us and the sun as it goes around the Earth. And so if the moon is right in front of the sun, that's a new moon. And if it's on the other side of the Earth, that's a full moon. So in between, you have first quarter, and you have some other phases, crescent and gibbous phases, and last quarter. Any object that passes between us and the sun will go through phases, including Venus, by the way.
And we always see the same, the same face of the moon is always getting the sunlight, right? Sometimes that face is away from us, sometimes it's toward us.
Yeah, the same side of the moon is towards the Earth all the time. So over a period of years, we see about 58-59% of the moon. And the reason for that is that the rotation rate of the moon is locked to its revolution rate around the Earth. So it rotates on its axis once a month, whereas the moon goes around the Earth once a month. And that's a locking system that is in place there.
All right, we have another astronomical question with David on the line in Osseo. David, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What do you got?
If the universe started with a Big Bang, infinitely small, or at least very, very small, and a huge amount of energy, and there was an explosion, then how is it that the universe is expanding and accelerating? My understanding is that all objects that have mass have gravity to some degree. How is it that the universe is expanding, but increasingly expanding? In other words, accelerating, it should be decelerating.
Well, Rob, you have some tough questions there. And that's a good one, but from my understanding is that when the Big Bang occurred, all objects that were created moved away. And so we, on Earth here, when we look out, we see things moving away from us in every direction. It's much like if you put a dot on a balloon and then a series of other dots. You took one big dot and you kept blowing that balloon up. If you were on that big dot, you would see all those other little dots moving away. And the amazing thing is the objects that are the furthest away are the ones that are moving the fastest, which is an additional proof of the Big Bang explosion roughly 14.3 billion years ago.
Interesting. And I know there's probably a lot of math and observation going into trying to figure out exactly how that's working.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, David. We go to Jeremy in Milwaukee now. Jeremy, hi.
Am I on?
You are on, Jeremy. What's your question?
Oh, sorry. My question is this. As a big science fiction fan, I've always wondered, as I've heard, that it's impossible to go faster than the speed of light. So I guess the two-parter, is that so, why?
Well, that's an Einstein idea. There is that the speed limit of the universe is the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, roughly. And if you go faster than that, God will pull you over, if you will. There's some speculation, something called worm tubes or wormholes, that things can go faster than the speed of light. It's very speculative, and there's not a lot of proof there. But I think it has to do a lot with the idea of relativity. I can't get any better answer than that.
And there was a brief glimmer of hope or thought that something had traveled faster than light, the CERN, C-E-R-N, I think it was, where it looked like a neutrino or something like that had gone faster than the speed of light. But looking back, they had other people check it out, and the measurements were just a bit off.
Yes, I remember reading about that. That's right, yes. Mm-hmm.
That's part of the fun part of science, isn't it? Or I don't know if it's fun for the people involved, but you find something, you put out your results, and then let everybody else try to pick holes in it.
Yes, that's right, yeah. And I get some feedback from the questions that I put in the newspaper every week, and they're good questions that people bring up. I was trained in the physical sciences, chemistry and physics, so in the life sciences, and there are quite a few questions about life sciences, geology, geography, and so forth, that I have to turn to people that know something about it. So I have a couple of doctors in Tolma that I talk to, and a dentist, an engineer, a couple of professors from the University of Milwaukee that are retired. So nobody has the answer to everything. So I tend to be very humble about that and say, well, I just don't know. The other day I was to a meeting and somebody brought in some mushrooms and thought I should be able to identify those mushrooms. Well, I don't know much about mushrooms, you see. So the world is too big and there's too much information out there to know everything.
You had here's one fun biology question you tackled in the book. Why do we get hiccups?
Oh, hiccups now, I have to take a look at that again, but I think it has a lot to do with the muscles that are in the diaphragm, and they get irritated. And so when those muscles get irritated, the muscles will stretch and cause the hiccup then.
And I'm worried that there'll be some kind of psychosomatic impact of me even bringing it up, and I'll hiccup the rest of the show. Knock on wood, which isn't science, but we'll hope that doesn't happen. Julian in Milwaukee is with us now. Julian, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. My question, is time linear and is time travel possible? Two questions, I guess.
very good question. Well, about time being linear, that I tend to believe is true. Time is one of those big mysteries. There was a Nobel Prize-winning scientist that says time is a way of having everything not get in the way of each other. And another scientist said time is one damn thing after another. But time travel, I think, is way out there. I do not think, of course, the theory of relativity says that there's time dilation. So if you travel fast enough, then time will slow down for the person who is the traveler. However, we don't have near the energy to make things travel anywhere, any object of any consequence travel near the speed of sound. For example, the fastest man ever traveled was 5 miles a second coming back from the moon, and 7 miles a second. And light travels 186,000 miles a second. So we're not even close to that. We can make things in accelerators go close to the speed of light, but those are very tiny particles with very little mass.
Thanks for the call, Julian. And one more call. We've got Joe in Prairie du Chien. Hi there, Joe.
Hi. See, I've always wondered, when you roll up a garden hose, you lay it out flat in a linear effect, and you coil it up, you have to rotate it as you pull it in or twist. Is that something akin to Newton's bucket of water? Is that space acting on matter?
You mean when the water is going through, Joel, the water is going through the hose?
No, not the hose. When Newton took a bucket and spun it, the water sits still for a moment and then picks up. And is that the effect, the drag, let's say, that space has on time? And is that something when you coil up a three-dimensional object, if the hose were just a pure line, would you have to coil it? Hmm. Would you have to let it rotate as you pull it into the coil?
Interesting.
Well, that's a good question, and I don't think I really have a good answer for that one, Joe.
That's taking me back. It sounds like something they might have asked me on a physics exam back in high school or college and try to blow my mind.
Yes.
I've got to think that's just the 3D geometry, though. I don't know if it's good, if it's
right.
That funky.
Yeah.
I've already rolled up my hoses for the winter.
They're all done.
Well, before I let you go, Larry, when you get that question you can't answer, you don't know the answer to right off the bat, like what kind of mushroom is this? What's next? How do you pursue it beyond there?
Oh, I look up on the internet and then I ask people who know a lot. We have some good biology teachers here in Tolma, so I ask questions of them. And you know, if you ask around, there's somebody usually will have answers to questions. And. And that's why I'm very grateful for that.
And don't be afraid to ask the question.
That's right. And at the end of each, most of the questions, I tend to put a little pun or a little joke about one out of every four if it pertains to something. And people kind of like that, so I enjoy doing that.
Larry?
They get their picture in the paper, and they get a coupon from McDonald's and from Pizza Hut, and so it's a...
Well,
a great adventure.
I need to start writing some questions up to Tolma there. Larry, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas to you and everybody at WPR and also all your listeners.
To you as well. That was Mr. Science, Larry Shekel, author of Ask a Science Teacher.